Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
President-elect Barack Obama just finished a news conference where he announced former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker is his choice to head a new White House panel to help create jobs and bring stability to the ailing financial system. The 81-year-old Volcker will head the president's Economic Recovery Advisory Board. The board's top staff official will be Austin Goolsbee, a University of Chicago economist and a frequent guest of the Brian Lehrer Show. News is also leaking today that President-elect Obama plans to stick with Defense Secretary Robert Gates in his new administration. My next guest probably thinks continuity is not what the new president should be seeking when it comes to the global war on terror. Gilles Capel is professor and chairman of Middle East Studies at the Institute of Political Studies in Paris, and his latest book is Beyond Terror and Martyrdom, The Future of the Middle East. It's from Harvard University Press. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
And I'm Amy Eddings. I'm sitting in for Brian Lehrer this morning. Mr. Capel, your basic premise is that the Bush war on terror and bin Laden's call for spectacular martyrdom are equal failures.
Yes, I guess that both created grand narratives that wanted to mobilize support. The grand narrative of the war on terror wanted to mobilize support from the Western public opinion, so that not only would the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda people be destroyed, but also the whole Middle East would be reshuffled, that Iraq would turn into, Saddam Hussein would be toppled, Iraq would turn into a friendly Western and U.S. country. But this did not work out, obviously, with the quagmire in Iraq. And by the same token, the grand narrative of bin Laden and Osama and Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's the real ideologue between that, wanted to mobilize Muslims and to make them believe that they could topple the system, topple the powers that be. And because they had failed in the 1990s in mobilizing the masses, because they could not lead the guerrilla wars that they had implemented, then they thought that martyrdom would be a sort of symbol that would ease the mobilization. Martyrdom as displayed on satellite TV, on Al Jazeera, on the internet, and that would be the sparkle that would ignite, if you wish, the whole the fire for the whole plane, as they used to say. This is something that also failed, and in a way, the symmetry of both illusions was Iraq, because as Americans and Al Qaeda jihadists were fighting each other, their common nemesis, Iran, was finally the one that came out as the kingmaker. And the most paradoxical, maybe, sign of all that was when President Ahmadinejad of Iran visited Baghdad early this week, in the spring this year, protected by 160,000 American servicemen, and shook the hand of Jalal Talabani, the Kurd president of the Republic of Iraq. I guess Saddam Hussein's corpse must have quivered in his tomb.
Well, if these grand narratives failed, if you back away from the grand narrative, couldn't you also make the case that both succeeded in their own way? Al-Qaeda has completely transformed U.S. foreign policy and immigration policy. There hasn't been an attack on U.S. soil since September 11, 2001, although, of course, this morning we're hearing of a plausible but unsubstantiated report that Al-Qaeda operatives were discussing an attack on New York City's subways in September. So in that regard, could you say that Al-Qaeda succeeded?
Well, in a way, yeah, you can say that Al-Qaeda succeeded, but Al-Qaeda in this case is more of a symptom of the change in the world order than a cause, right? Because maybe one of the vagaries of the neocons was to believe that the world was unipolar, that there was just the U.S. and the rest, and that it could impose its order, and that that was it. But actually, the world is multipolar, and it was already when President W. Bush took power. And amongst those new centers of powers which are being created, which are emerging, not only do you have regional centers like India, Russia, what they call the BRIC countries, and whatever, Europe and the Mediterranean, or GCC, or the Gulf countries, but also a number of groups which manage to take over media attention, which use means like terrorism and so on and so forth. You can have large corporations or things like that. You know, this is part and parcel of the new world system, and Al-Qaeda is a byproduct of that. It's not its cause.
Does Al-Qaeda's failure matter if its brand of warfare almost presupposes that it operates from a weaker position? I mean, it only takes chatter about a subway plot to put people on alert.
True, and it may not even be Al-Qaeda. I mean, it may be a brand name.
Right.
Because, you know, a number of groups now use the Al-Qaeda name to bring attention. If you say that the whatever, the Filipino something group prepares a plot, it's not going to make news for WNYC.
Right.
Whereas if they can't stick the Al-Qaeda label immediately, you're gonna give it attention.
Right, right. To my question, do you think it matters to Al-Qaeda that this global jihad didn't matter if how it succeeds is to operate on the fringes?
Well, it does matter a lot because there is now a terrible internal strife within the sort of the Al-Qaeda ideology, and its main ideologue, Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's an Egyptian MD and who just abused President Obama, called him a nigger, actually, not only a house negro, as the English translation had it, and using, you know, reference to Malcolm X, that was understandable only to people who listen to WNYC, but not probably to the hoi polloi. Actually, when he listened to the declaration, the statement in Arabic, he called him abid, and abid is a word in Arabic which means slave, hence black. And it would be sort of a nigger if you were in derogatory parlance in English, and which is something very harsh. Why is it that he tried to use that to destroy the image of President-elect Obama, which has a great popularity, and who's probably able to play a big role in order to reassess America's standing in this part of the world? Well, because he wanted to find a way to put himself back in the front line of the Al-Qaeda and jihadist discourse, because he's been accused by a number of his former brothers or comrades, as others would say, to have led Al-Qaeda into the wall, to the failure, because of the spilling of Muslim blood, you know, in Iraq, because the Al-Qaeda jihadists were hijacked to a large extent by Sunni radicals before those Sunnis were bought into the awakening movement, thanks to General Petraeus's policy. Because of that, they killed mostly Shias. I mean, they killed American and foreign soldiers, but they killed mostly Shias. So when you have someone out in the blue or in the green of the Muslim Ummah, the Muslim world, listening that someone called Muhammad killed someone who was also called Muhammad, then this is not jihad anymore. This is fitna. That is strife within the ranks of Muslims. This is something that will lead to the breakaway of the community and to disaster. And that means that support for Al-Qaeda is more and more difficult to get. And, you know, the problem now is how long the center of this movement can survive out of southern Waziristan, and what kind of protections it has so that it can go there. And if you go to Al-Zawahiri's, if you see from the outside what the studios of Al-Zawahiri's are, where he tapes his and the image is perfect, and that's as beautiful as your new studio here, right? So this is not something that can survive on the goat's milk of a few peasant tribes. It has to have some help from certain elements within the Pakistani intelligence system. And, you know, if the war now is brought into southern Waziristan in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and if there is a significant involvement of elements in the Pakistani forces to decide that they have to wipe out the Al-Qaeda leadership, then things will definitely change. And this is part and parcel of the commitments for the new president.
This is the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Brian, and we can take a couple of calls for Professor Capel. Do you think Obama gets a clean slate in the Islamic world? Call us at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. How does the election of Barack Obama change the game? Barack Hussein Obama.
Yeah, well, to some extent, he's... I guess that this is someone who will have have in his priority, and he already said so, to try to make a deal with the Iranians. And making a deal with Iran does not mean that you have to surrender to their will. On the contrary, I guess that one of the reasons you had neocons in Tehran was that you had neocons in Washington. Hmm. And, you know, the radicals in Tehran sort of benefited from the quagmire in Iraq, and they used or they monitored or inspired the 33-day war in 2006 against Israel. They sort of engineer the nuclear blackmail, and this was something that definitely was okay as long as you had in front they had in front of them someone who said no response. Nowadays, if there is some sort of an offer that allows for Iran to be back part of the security system in the Gulf, that the embargo can be lifted under some conditions, then this will lead necessarily to a change within the Iranian leadership, because the reason why President Khatami was ousted finally was that, you know, he had made openings to the U.S., and they had been turned down when President Bush, in the State of the Union statement of January 2002, told them that you're just part of the axis of evil. And this undermined Khatami's position within the Iranian establishment and helped the radicals to win. So I think that if we have another will, now it will be something that will lead to significant change. On a most humorous note, you know, you called him, he was called Barack, mm-hmm. Barack or Mubarak Hussein Obama, and Obama in Farsi means he is with us, right? So Hussein is with us, and Hussein is the sort of charismatic character, the archetype of the good man in Shia religion. So definitely, if you judge by names, only Hussein Obama has many more credentials than poor Ahmadinejad, who's after all the son of the cobbler.
Huh. That's what his name means.
No. It means Ahmadinejad. No, it means someone has to go with Ahmed. I mean,
I want to ask you about your solution step, your third way. But first, before we move on to that, I wanted to ask you what the biggest misperception what do you believe the biggest misperception is that Americans hold about the war on terror?
Well, Americans have changed, and they have not. They have voted in Barack Obama, among other things, because he decided to. Well, because the economy was what it was, of course, but because he had said that he wanted to close down Guantanamo, and because he wanted to pull troops out of Iraq.
Oh, well, Senator John McCain wanted to close down Guantanamo too.
Yes, he did, but definitely. I mean, I'm not an American citizen nor a voter, but I imagine that the difference between President-elect Obama and Senator McCain was sort of their distanciation from President Bush was bigger in one case than another, even though candidate McCain did not really want to stick with President W's image. But the I guess that the the biggest misperception originally was that the war on terror was really a war on terror, whereas the war on terror was but an umbrella name, if you wish, which allowed for President Bush's policy to not only track the terrorists, but also to engineer a major change in the Middle East, which said it would lead to the democratization, but which we never saw whether it would have led or not to democratization, but it led to the chaos in Iraq. And this is something that I guess the American public, that was originally enthusiastically for the war on terror, finally they just discovered or thought that they had been cheated, that it had been a fraudulent thing, and this is what the political sanction proved.
I'm speaking with Gilles Kepel, the author of Beyond Terror and Martyrdom, The Future of the Middle East, published by Harvard University Press. And we're taking your calls for Professor Kepel at 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. What do you believe is the way out of the strife in the Middle East? Let's get some suggestions here, this longstanding problem. The solution you see is for a third way, and perhaps not surprisingly for a Frenchman, it's what France is doing. Greater economic ties between the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. How does that defeat radical Islam and terrorism?
Well, it's not a French solution. It's more of a European thing. You know, France is nothing nowadays, unfortunately. Much to our regret, it's just part of the 27-strong European Union.
But you do take issue with other European countries'
yes,
approach.
Yes, definitely, because there is an important debate nowadays in the European Union as how we should deal with the people from with the populations from Muslim descent who have become Europeans. Should we have a sort of multicultural approach, as was the case in Britain and in the Netherlands, where what was valued was the difference over what was in common between the host community and the guest community? Or, on the contrary, should we value the commonality over the difference, as was implemented in the French system? Now, when the French blamed the wearing of the... did not allow for the wearing of veils in schools, I mean, they were blamed as fascists or what have you, assimilationists, and whereas in Britain this was, you know, allowed, and whatever difference you wanted to express was welcome. Now, the problem was that 7/7, the bombings in London, have called into question all the multicultural system, and such as the stabbing of Theo van Gogh in the Netherlands, because what was discovered was that because there was so little in common between the guest and the host communities, then within the shelter of the sort of impenetrable guest community, terrorists could thrive, right? Whereas, as opposed to that in France, even though we have the biggest amount of Muslims in Europe, we haven't had anything in terms of violence since 1996, when the Algerian War spilt over into France, for a number of reasons, because maybe the policing is more efficient, and also because I believe that most people from Muslim descent in France feel French, and they consider that they should not shelter, give any shelter to radicals or terrorists, because this is going to jeopardize all the efforts they made for their upward social mobility. So this is the debate which is now raging in Europe between the multiculturalist and the integrationist. And I believe that this process of integration is giving an extraordinary model, if you wish, role model for cousins, brothers, and whatever who are still in North Africa or Turkey and the like. And the media is a two-way street, because it carries the Osama bin Laden, the Al Jazeera message, but also carries a democratization model which is not parachuted as was the one supposed to be parachuted into Baghdad by U.S. forces, but it permeates society from below.
I want to address this issue of integration, though. Forgive me for this, but my impression of France is not that integration has worked. What about the riots in the Paris suburbs, the isolation that these immigrant communities felt from French culture, French life, French economic well-being? How do you explain that and say that France is a great model of integration of its immigrant populations?
No, the riots in the fall of 2005 were not as it was said over here, and then you could see it on Fox News, and that is Muslim riots where you had Al-Qaeda people ready to seize Paris because they were radicals and so on and so forth. They were precisely riots for more integration into the system. They were riots of young people who felt alienated and who wanted to be more integrated. I mean, it was not something that said that they were willing to build some sort of Islamistan in the banlieues, as you know, that the only word that French language has given to the universal parlance now is banlieue.
Mm-hmm.
The old days it was champagne or parfum. That's finished. And so this is it. And I don't say that the system is perfect, but what I want to say is that this is what has to be achieved. And it has not been achieved well in France. There's no doubt about it. But this is the direction in which I believe we're going in Europe. And nowadays, because of 7/7, because of the stabbing, and because of terrorism, the multiculturalist model in Britain and in the Netherlands and the other countries where it was implemented is being very seriously called into question, which is something which we did not see at the time.
I'd like to take a call. James from Howard Beach, you're on WNYC with Professor Gilles Kapel. Good morning, James.
Good morning. Thank you. I think we should take a page from France and realize that the Iranians are the Gulf superpower, and we have to sit down with them and find common ground. The Iranian Sunnis have the power to shut down the Iranian Shia have the power to shut down the Sunni Takfiris. They don't want this instability on their border, and I want to see what the professor feels about that.
Thank you, James, for your call.
Well, I guess that talking to the Iranians, of course, is a means at the end of the day to secure the oil shipments that go through the Straits of Hormuz. Every day, one-fourth of the world's oil consumption goes through there. And Iran is a central part of the security system of the Gulf, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem is that the present Iran, under the present Iranian administration, is not interested into that. They are, on the contrary, they want to play the bad guys. But if a deal is made with them, with the Iranian authorities, that they can get back into a system which brings them prosperity and the like, in my view, this is going to introduce an enormous change within the Iranian establishment, and the radicals are going to be marginalized. Then it is for the Iranians to take over and to decide what they want to do with their own regime. But I guess that, you know, the strike against Iran would have, on the contrary, been the best means to sort of bring together Iranians of whatever sensibility in favor of the regime. I know some friends of mine in Iran who eat a mollah cooked in wine every morning for breakfast, and who, you know, who would have got together with the regime had the strike been done. On the contrary, an opening is going to isolate, I believe, the radicals in power.
I saw where you took issue with Condoleezza Rice's statement that the U.S. will do the cooking and Europe can do the dishes when it comes to the Middle East. Is your biggest hope for Barack Obama is that he lets France back in the kitchen?
Well, for a Frenchman, of course, for a country of gastronomy, to do the dishes while McDonald's eaters do the cooking, of course, is a personal insult. But the it's not France there again; it's Europe. And I believe that nowadays, I mean, what America has discovered, due also to the war in Iraq and to the misperceptions of the Bush administration, is that it can't do anything alone. It's too expensive. It's broke. America is still necessary wherever, but it is not sufficient.
And it has to do with
allies.
And yet, if we become more economically integrated the way France and Germany have with Iran, doesn't that leave us unable to oppose that country's development of nuclear weapons?
Well, the issue of nuclear energy is something very difficult to deal with. It is difficult to imagine that nuclear energy will be reserved only to the club of the rich. And you know, if we're serious about sustainable development, then we have to to think that there is no other solution than the generalization of nuclear power and nuclear energy for Pacific purpose, but then you don't have to hide yourself under your little finger. When you have nuclear energy for Pacific purpose, it is not very difficult to build a bomb. Hence, what we have to do is to try to manage a world system where there will be nuclear power, and this is the difficulty. And the issue is not to say, hey, you give the nuclear plans to the Iranians. It's that you have first to make sure that they will be integrated in a system where they do not want to use that for military purpose. And, you know, for instance, if you have a nuclear plant in the Iranian side of the Persian Gulf and another one Saudi Arabian side, if one bombs the other, I'm sure that the cloud will not make any difference between Shias and Sunnis or Arabs and Persians, right?
Right. We'll have to leave it there. I've been speaking with French Middle East scholar Gilles Capel about his new book, Beyond Terror and Martyrdom, The Future of the Middle East. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Up next, as people start heading home for the holidays, we will hear stories of immigrants heading home for good. Stay tuned.